We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
7:43, 17 before 8, Tommy Tucker. It is Wednesday, April 8th, in case you've lost track of it. It is Holy Week. Tomorrow, Holy Thursday, then Good Friday, Saturday, Holy Saturday, if you're a Christian, and then Sunday, Easter Sunday, and it'll definitely be different. At least let's hope it is, because we still want people to engage in those social distancing measures or physical distancing. Our friend joins us now. Stanley Perlman, professor of microbiology and of pediatric infectious diseases at the University of Iowa. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. I appreciate the time because I know you're busy. In terms of normalcy, in terms of getting back to everyday life in the United States or even the world with the coronavirus, do we even have a definition? Are there metrics as far as what normal would be or when we can leave our houses and go back to doing what we were doing before this nightmare?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't think I have a good answer for that. I think that we have to depend really on what the data show us. How fast are we back to having no mortalities, no one dying from this disease, and very limited transmission? Because, of course, the concern is if we go back too soon, we're going to have a second wave, and people who weren't infected the first time will become infected the second time. So this is really just a healthcare authorities having to help us decide when it's safe to open up our factories and stores again so we don't have a second wave. It's really hard to know when that'll be.
I cannot imagine that happening by April 30th. Is there any way you see that?
No, I think it'd be very hard to imagine. That's only 3 weeks away now, and it's hard to imagine we'll be back there. The other thing that we learned from looking at China, so China has no cases now, and it took a long time to get there. But so the authorities tried to open up factories and have people go back to work earlier than that, and basically they voted with their feet, and they didn't go back to work. Some did. People couldn't return from their villages. They didn't want to return. So I think that no matter what we say could happen, there's still going to be people who want to be convinced that it's safe.
You know, I saw this quote. Apparently New Zealand's done a very good job of getting on this early. I don't know if that's because they had the advantage of hindsight to see what happened in other countries. But a businessman said, and I wrote this down, it's inevitable that we'll have to shut down anyway, so we would rather it to be sharp and short. But it's too late for that here, is it not? And as it relates to flattening the curve and lengthening this whole thing, the idea being that hospitals don't get overwhelmed, and I guess that more people survive, are we doing enough now? Is there any way to speed this up? And are we even flattening the curve?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think we probably are flattening the curve in most of the country. I'm not convinced that New York and New Jersey have flattened their curve yet. It could have been worse if they didn't have the shelter-in-place orders there. So we don't really know. There's certainly so much damage being done in those areas that it's just incredibly sad. But I think places like New Zealand just jumped on it earlier. I was just reading the other day that places even in Africa where they have almost no cases are doing shelter in place just to make sure there are no cases. So we didn't do that. We didn't jump on it soon enough. We had no testing, a very poor testing. So we did a lot of things wrong. That's why we're playing catch up in so many ways.
So even when it comes to areas, and partial opening and partial openings in different areas. I don't know, because so many people can carry this and be asymptomatic and not everybody's going to be tested. I don't understand how you can do this regionally unless you have some pretty harsh travel restrictions. Is that medically sound?
Yeah, well, I think that you're right. I think when you have a lot of asymptomatic people, that's why people are very keen on having this shelter in place and having people not leave, because you really don't know whether an asymptomatic person can. We know that asymptomatic people or people who have very mild symptoms can affect other people. We don't really know if somebody who has no symptoms can really infect other people. We think it, but we don't know it. We know they have virus on them, but it's really still, the epidemiology is still really not completely well known, so it's hard to know. That's why most states, I think what I read was 80% of the U.S. now is a shelter in place, so that to minimize this kind of spread.
Are there any statistics available? Because we were talking to a nurse yesterday from a hospital, and y'all can still find that interview at WWL.com. It was more listening than an interview, really, and she was describing in detail the challenges that they face. And I was just wondering, it was a pretty emotional moment then, and I didn't want to ask this question, but I'll ask you, in terms of people with underlying health conditions, once they go on a ventilator, is it extremely rare that they come back from that?
Well, I think the ventilator numbers I've read are around 50% recover if they've been on a ventilator, and I think what you would have to say is that the sicker someone was when they began, the more underlying problems, the odds of recovering are less. It's not really anything to do with COVID-19 at that point. It's really that you have damaged lungs and the body has to be strong enough to be able to recover. So it's not the virus per se. It's really somebody with comorbidities. Just like if somebody has comorbidities and they have some other illness, it's just harder for them to recover.
Even a cold or bronchitis, and I'm not minimizing COVID. I'm just saying that if you have those underlying health conditions and you get even sicker, you're going to be up against it.
Yeah, that's really it. And, with COVID-19, and if you're on a respirator, of course, it's even one degree harder. But that basically, that's underlying conditions are such a big problem for a lot of diseases. Even if somebody breaks their hip, they go to the hospital. If they have underlying conditions, the recovery is going to be longer.
Doctor, that's an excellent point that I have not heard made yet. And a lot of us go through it with elderly parents where they break their hip and it's hard for them to ever come back from that. 7:50, 10 till 8. When we come back, I want to talk, Doctor, about hydroxychloroquine. It's become politically controversial, which you know better than I, that politics and science and medicine, they don't go together at all. But we'll talk about it when we return. 7:50, time for traffic now on WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, 7:55. Stanley Perelman, nice enough to spend some time with us, professor of microbiology and of pediatric infectious diseases at the University of Iowa, a friend of ours with whom we've spoken couple of different times. Dr. Perelman, when it comes to hydroxychloroquine, I'm getting the texts here that are now making it terribly political, tying it into different networks. I get a text saying that it saved somebody's life. I get another text saying that it caused somebody their life because of heart trouble. Medically, let's leave the politics out of this about who's for it, who's against it. Medically, doctors, your thoughts on hydroxychloroquine and ZPAC, et cetera.
Yeah, no, I know this has become, just as you said, very political. Before, and it's unfortunately based on a few studies that are not good from France. They were studies without controls. So one of the things that we have to do in medicine is if somebody has an idea for therapy, you always have to weigh the possibility that the therapy is making someone get better, if in fact the patient gets better, versus he or she would get better by themselves. So that's why we are so keen on having controlled studies to evaluate different drugs. So this particular drug was recommended on the basis of several very non-controlled studies. Patients received them, and then the patients got better. but there was no evidence that the patients actually got better because of the drug. This drug, particularly chloroquine, which is the next-door relative of hydroxychloroquine, has been studied in coronaviruses for years, and it theoretically should not work in the case of COVID-19. It works by preventing virus from getting into cells, but it does it by the pathway that's not used in the lungs of people who get infected. There's two ways for viruses to get into cells, and hydroxychloroquine is not predicted to affect the one that matters the most. So those of us who have thought about the viruses for a long time don't think it'll work. On the other hand, stranger things have happened, so sometimes drugs work even when they're predicted not to, and that's why you have to do large studies to see if it has any efficacy. Azithromycin, as far as I can tell, has no role whatsoever, but hydroxychloroquine, I'm sure that it's not going to work, but the only way to prove me wrong is to do a controlled study and see if it actually helps people. So that's where the politics comes in, because we don't have a controlled study, and then people go in their feelings, and these anecdotes. People have died from overdoses because this drug has toxicity. Maybe people have gotten better, plus or minus the drug. It's so hard without medical knowledge without medical information to really have a firm statement one way or the other. But all I can say is it's predicted not to work.
And each patient is different as well with underlying conditions, et cetera. As a physician, if you saw no sign of improvement from a patient, and I don't know if this is administered before they're on a ventilator or after, would you prescribe it if it was a dire situation and the person you thought was pretty much going to die anyway?
No, because, you know, all these drugs, even the one that has the best chances of working, the ones like remdesivir, which is often used, or convalescent plasma, they really work when you catch someone at the beginning of the infection. By the time people are dying from this virus, the virus itself is probably not there very much. It's probably mostly the body has reacted against the virus, and there's so much destruction of the lungs and other tissues that there may be some virus left, but getting rid of the little bit that's left won't help at that point. So I as a physician, I understand the feeling that you want to do something, you have to do something. But a drug like hydroxychloroquine, when someone's really sick, and which could put them over the edge by damaging their heart further or causing a heart problem, I wouldn't use that one. The others I don't think would be negative, but I don't think they'd help. It's just really hard, both as a patient and a doctor and the doctor and the family, to sit there not really knowing what to do. But that's where we are with this. We do not have good therapies for someone who's really sick.
Thank you, Doc.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.